Morning, Your Honors. Laird Osmond on behalf of both appellants Tasha and Jarek. Your Honors, as you're aware, there are two issues before you on appeal. The first being whether there was error to grant summary judgment for Norfolk, and the second being whether or not the refusal to grant plaintiffs leave to file a second amended complaint. As to summary judgment, the evidence presented in the trial courts clearly provided an issue of fact as to whether or not there was, in fact, an open and obvious condition, and also as to whether or not the conduct alleged against Norfolk was willful and wanton. Appellants will rely on extensive arguments in our brief, but suffice to say, as to the open and obvious issue, the condition is claimed to have been open and obvious by Norfolk, and to them it should be, because they created it. There was extensive evidence that to everyone else, the unwary, that it was not open and obvious. In fact, that its visibility prevented them from acting in a timely fashion. That evidence, by both appellants and witnesses, was further bolstered by expert testimony that, in fact, the perception point was about 100 to 130 feet, whereas the stopping time was about 200 to 308 feet. Clearly, an issue of fact was created that was not properly dealt with by the trial court. This was further supported when you take into account the issues and the expansion of the duty that's provided in Ward versus Kmart. In this case, the defendant created a condition. The evidence was clear in the record that there was an issue as to whether or not this condition was readily perceptible, and therefore there was an issue as to whether it was open and obvious that should not have been disposed of. The other part of their argument is that the conduct, even if this was not open and obvious, was not willful and wanton. The gist of their argument was that they had no knowledge of this danger because, one, there was no prior complaints or no evidence of any prior accidents. I submit both arguments are absurd. They certainly had knowledge. They created the dangerous condition. They removed the bridge. They admitted that. They admit that persons like the appellants might use their rail bed for recreational purposes. They admitted that in the early 90s they instituted a program to put barricades up in order to prevent people from driving off the edge of these abandoned railroad bridges. They admitted that they used ballast and that it had to be made into a certain angle so that motorcycles wouldn't be able to use it as a ramp. They anticipated that motorcycles would be used on their rail beds, and at the same time, they were aware that the ballast that they used on some of these rail beds to block them off would be tampered with and would require guardrails. So they knew there was a difficulty with the very attempts they made to prevent these rail beds from being a hazard. They say they had no notice of any prior accidents. Obviously, we submitted in our reply that there was a case out of the Seventh Circuit here dealing with the same sort of issue. They certainly had knowledge that these rail beds would be used in this way. As to the issue of complaints, the district court based its finding on that there were no complaints to the railroad, therefore there could not have been any willful and wanton conduct. The issue is not complaints. The issue is the creation of a danger, removing the bridge. The issue is the defendant's knowledge that the only safeguard they provided the public was known by themselves to be inadequate, and that the ballast would be pilfered and taken away. Piles of gravel the public felt were abandoned. And then the defendant's utter indifference, well knowing the serious consequences that they of the condition they created, they did nothing. They never inspected, they never put up any guardrail signs, anything. These cases that are cited by the defendant don't deal with the creation of a danger by the defendant, and that's a distinction here. And I believe summary judgment was therefore precluded. The second issue is the Recreational Use Act. For this court to properly apply the Recreational Use Act, it has to be read in its totality, not excising and emphasizing one section while totally ignoring...
Does the statute have any bearing on the outcome? There's a willful and wanton exception to the statute, and willful and wanton also seems to be the standard normally appropriate for trespassers. So what effect would the statute have?
Well, this issue arises before the court because we asked to file an amended complaint wherein we were pleading negligence. And the court would not allow that, saying that the Recreational Use Act applies, therefore you can't have negligence. So in this context, It makes a big difference because, obviously, if you have an anticipated trespasser, then you have an issue as to whether or not there should be a different standard than willful and wanton.
No, assume that that's not a correct statement of the law in Illinois, and that willful and wanton is the standard due to trespassers, including trespassers that you know are trespassers, because you can't stop trespassers from getting on your property. What difference does the Act make?
Well, the difference is that the Act does not allow for negligence, and assuming that you're going to say that there is no situation that can be pled here wherein the creation of the danger that they provided would not qualify for them to use ordinary care rather than to use willful and wanton, I think it makes a big difference. I think that the use of the Recreational Use Act and Water Act by defendants such as Norfolk is completely absurd, because otherwise why have the Act at all? Why not just grant blanket immunity to landowners? And that certainly isn't the intent here. And I believe that we had a right to file a complaint and state a cause of action. And whether or not at some point subsequent here too, there may be another motion which addresses that issue, that's not before this court right now. What is before this court is whether or not the district court was incorrect in saying the Recreational Use Act does not apply to Norfolk under the facts of this case. Basically, the bottom line on that argument, I don't want to use up my time for rebuttal, but the disagreement on its application only comes in cases where it's a matter of limitation of permission, either in time or in the person that is being allowed to use the land. There are no cases where the defendants had totally prohibited the use of their land by the public where the Act was found to apply. The Stryker case, which in fact my father's office handled some 20 years ago, it was a limitation that still allowed the use of the Act as a basis to give immunity. I will reserve the rest of my time based upon the light coming on and defer to counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hazard. Mr. Goble?
May it please the Court, on behalf of Norfolk Southern Railway Company, I'd first like to correct a misstatement that appears in our brief at page 20 in a parenthetical where we're discussing accidents at other locations. Based on the record evidence, that's a correct statement. None of the witnesses and none of the evidence adduced in the court below indicated any other accidents were known to any of the parties involved here at any other locations on Norfolk's system. But based on the Swift case, which was cited by Mr. Osmond in his reply brief, it does appear that there was at least one other incident in a separate area somewhere near Streeter, Illinois. However, that case, first, was not raised, not a matter of record below, not an argument not made in Mr. Osmond's opening brief in his wave. More importantly, Swift is distinguishable on both the facts and the law. Initially, the district court in Swift upheld the application of the Recreational Use Act, like the court here applied, and the district court then relied on an Illinois appellate court case called Smith versus City of Chicago for its formulation of duty by which it found an issue of fact as to Norfolk's willful and wanton conduct. That Smith case was reversed by the Illinois Supreme Court in a case we cite in our brief, Buchalera's versus the Chicago Park District, a consolidated case. And interestingly, Buchalera's deals with an open and obvious danger to swimmers diving into Lake Michigan, and found that in both Buchalera's and Smith, it did not even need to reach the issue of willful and wanton misconduct because the danger presented to the plaintiffs in those cases was open and obvious. Factually, on the Swift case, according to the district court's opinion, that accident occurred in a populated area near schools, residences, and roads, whereas this accident occurred in a rural area. And that accident in Swift occurred before Norfolk enacted a policy requiring that when bridges are removed on abandoned rail lines, that an earthen barricade be installed. In our cases, the policy at the time required the installation of an earthen barricade when the bridges were removed, and although there is no direct evidence of a post-removal inspection, there is substantial circumstantial evidence that in fact that was the policy and that's what was followed. As to the willful and wanton standard, summary judgment was properly granted. The court first properly applied the Recreational Use Act, and having done so, found that there was no evidence of willful and wanton misconduct on behalf of Norfolk. Initially, Norfolk's contract called for the installation of an earthen barricade on both sides of the removed bridge. There's no evidence that this was not done, and as I said before, substantial circumstantial evidence that it was. Norfolk had had no complaints at this location regarding prior injuries or usage of the area, and no complaints regarding any misuse of this area. It didn't have any actual knowledge that the barriers were not present, and in the face of this uncontested evidence, Norfolk did not act with conscious disregard for others in the face of the known danger, which is what the court must find in order to find willful and wanton misconduct. All of the plaintiff's evidence regarding Norfolk's employees suggesting a barricade to be installed, such as a highway guardrail, came after their knowledge of these accidents and, in fact, is indication that Norfolk was acting responsibly. If, after learning of these accidents and learning that there were no barricades present at this location, Norfolk did nothing, then it could possibly be guilty of willful and wanton misconduct. But instead of sitting back, Norfolk took the proper action and through its real estate department arranged for the installation of highway-type barricades at this location.
Mr. Grove, isn't it true that the contract between Norfolk and Tie Yard spoke to the erection of the barriers to prevent trespassers from using the barricade to, quote, jump motorbikes or other such vehicles?
Well, the standard or the specification for the type of barricade called for the slopes of the barricade to be steep enough so that it would not be subjected to that use. That's correct, Judge.
So doesn't that speak a little bit to an anticipation that that might be an activity engaged in by trespass?
Well, Norfolk, if we just take this rail line for example, as I understand, the length of the abandoned rail line was in excess of 20 miles, and it's a gravel roadbed that goes primarily through rural areas. It's not fenced. We don't block off access to this at the streets it crosses or from people's backyards. So we probably have to be blind to say that no one is going to use it. We don't allow them to use it. We don't encourage the use. But certainly we have some understanding that people do trespass on our property all over the country. And apparently, although there's no record evidence on that, this specification was developed to prevent those people who are trespassing on Norfolk's property from doing injury to themselves while attempting to jump a barricade put there to prevent just that. In any event, that would not make, you only get to that issue, I think, if you say the Recreational Use Act doesn't apply. We have to deal with these plaintiffs as trespassers on the right-of-way, and are they anticipated trespassers? This court made clear in its decision in the Reed case that the anticipated trespasser exception does not apply to persons who are relying on others' use of the property to place them in that category. They have to be, first of all, the scope of the activity has to be limited to a very narrow area, and the plaintiffs have to be accustomed to using it. And then, and only then, does that anticipated trespasser exception apply.
How many times approximately do they have to use it to fit your category?
Judge, I don't know that there is any hard and fast time on that, but I think the anticipated trespasser exception has traditionally been limited under Illinois law to the well-worn path crossing the railroad right-of-way leading to the other side, not a 26-mile-long gravel roadbed with access from streets or backyards or fields, if you will. But there is no hard and fast standard. So in this case, under either formulation, either under the Recreational Use Act or under Illinois common law, Mr. Casey and Mr. Jarrett were trespassers. We only owed a duty to refrain from engaging in willful and wanton conduct. We didn't violate that duty, and summary judgment was properly granted.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Global. Mr. Austin.
Just so the record's clear, I didn't quite understand counsel's comment about there was strong circumstantial evidence concerning inspection. There never was any inspection. There was no policy for inspections. They chose to use gravel ballast as a barricade to take care of a problem they created. Whether that doesn't make it correct because they chose it. They had knowledge that this gravel was pilfered and taken away after it was placed there, and they had no duty, in their opinion, to inspect. Therefore, when these ballast barricades disappeared, it was as if they never put up any barricade at all. We're here discussing whether or not this issue was properly disposed of by a trial court without ever the opportunity of a jury to decide whether this conduct is tantamount to willful, wanton behavior. And I think with the evidence presented, the unrebutted expert testimony, this court is constrained to allow the trier of fact to make that decision. The issue regarding the Recreational Use Act, and I think that although there may be issues down the road regarding whether or not we qualify as an anticipated trespasser, none of that was developed for purposes of this appeal. We wanted the opportunity to develop that, and that's how the law progresses, is that there are issues and cases that place certain things before the court. We're asking for the opportunity to do that. The Recreational Use Act, by its very definition, by its very title, only gives immunity to landowners, and I quote, who make their land and water areas available. All of the cases cited regarding the application of the Recreational Use Act deal with an issue that, in fact, the use of the land was provided by the landowner, and it was a matter of how much or whether it was implied. And even in the case in front of the Seventh Circuit here, which we cited for the purpose of notice only of accident, that case, they discouraged using the land, but they did not outright prohibit it. The railroad in this case put up no trespassing signs, just as the court found in the Logan case, that the no trespassing signs alone expressed the intent that you didn't want the land used for recreational purposes, ergo, the act should not apply. We believe that it does in a case where you specifically keep people from using the land. If there's an issue of how much and how long or for what reason, the courts have been very liberal in saying, okay, we'll do that, because that does encourage the use of land by the public for recreation. When you provide no benefit to the public, you deserved no immunity from the law. And we ask that the summary judgment for the defendant, as well as the denial of leave to file our second amended complaint, be reversed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Austin. Thank you, Mr. Global. Case is taken under advisement.